Good morning.
Morning, how are you?
Good. Just logging in early to say hi.
Yeah. They had told us 20 minutes before, right? So we're right on time.
Yes. So I'll just be listening. It looks like it's recording right now. Should we stop the recording?
Let me just pause for now.
Okay, then.
All right. So we
Hello, everyone, and welcome. We're going to wait maybe another 2 or 3 minutes to allow a few more people to log in. We'll get started shortly. Thank you so much. Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome. to our Global Healthcare Entrepreneurship Seminar Series. My name is Professor Wilgina Glover. I'm faculty at Babson College. And we have the pleasure of partnering with the University of Global Health Equity for this seminar series. Our speaker for today is Dr. Rex Wong from the University of Global Health Equity. I'll introduce him briefly, and then he'll have much more to share with us. I think before I do that, I'll just say that for those of you that were on our call last week, this has just really been a pleasure to kind of start off and to think about what global healthcare entrepreneurship looks like and how we can become better at it, right? More efficient, more effective, and to create more successful ventures that will reach more people, right? In the spirit of equity. And so our first session really talked about global healthcare entrepreneurship more broadly. This one is here to present us with some practical challenges to have a sense of how do we ground this work in a space like Rwanda and other places, as Dr. Wong will be discussing. And then our session three will be about more of the tools and techniques of entrepreneurship that will be presented next week. And then finally, we'll be wrapping up with digital health. I did want to mention, and I'll place it in the chat, that we'll have a feedback form. So please fill that out for my session from last week. I'll put that in the chat just shortly. And then I'll wrap up and remind us to do it for Dr. Wong's chat. While we're here, and I see people saying, good day, everyone. Yes, let's type in the chat. I think that's the beauty of technology. Everyone can say good day, good morning, good afternoon, and maybe type where you're from so that we have a sense of who is joining us this morning. So I will do that as well. So good morning, or good afternoon. I know we are from many, many time zones on this chat. This is what's beautiful about it. Great, we have some visitors from all over. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening maybe for some. I know we had some visitors from India last week, which was great. There we go, I like it. I want to be on the moon as well. That's a good place to be broadcasting from. All right, without further ado, I will get us started with introducing our speaker for today, Dr. Rex Wong. Rex Wong is the director of Bill and Joyce Cummings Institute of Global Health of the University of Global Health Equity, directing and teaching the Master of Science in Global Health Delivery Program. He has over 30 years of hospital and healthcare work experience globally. He has worked and lived in 14 countries on various hospital management, national health systems, and senior leadership programs. Before joining UGHE, Dr. Wong was the director of Hospital Strengthening Initiative and a lecturer at Yale University, directing health management and hospital quality improvement projects. Quality improvement is near and dear to my heart, so that's exciting. He participated in two startup hospitals in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, set up the first amputee rehabilitation program in the Middle East. He was also involved in setting up 8 master degree programs in various universities. So we are very excited to hear from Dr. Rex Wong today. Rex.
Hey, thank you, Regina, for the opening of the session. And thanks for the introduction. I'm glad to have the opportunity to share some of my experience here. And I'm trying to get the slides working. Sometimes it freezes here. Sharing it again. Oh, hope you can see it. All right. So I'm glad to have the opportunity here to share some of my experiences. As Regina said, I'm currently in Rwanda, and I came to Rwanda about 10 years ago working on the Human Resources for Health program. And I joined the UGHE just a few years ago to start my full-time academic career. These are the countries that I lived in and worked in. And before joining UGHE, I was back in the States working at Yale, running a couple of different international programs with the Yale University. I work at private sector before, and I've set up a couple of hospitals in different countries. I spent quite some time in living in Ethiopia and involved in a hospital management initiative and helped set up some master programs there. And they're also involved in some national programs in different countries, including Liberia and Tanzania before. So I'm showing you this because I'm not a typical traditional academia in any sense. So I actually have more implementation and operation experience than my academic experience here. So today I'm happy to have the opportunity to share some of these stories and experience about the challenges in healthcare, as well as some of the implementation challenges in different countries. So what I want to do is I start with a poll. So if you can see the poll on the screen, I want to ask you two questions. So the first question is, if you got malaria, would you take this medicine from Uganda? So Joseph, can you pull up the poll for me? There you go. So quickly answer these two questions. So if you have malaria, will you take this lemongrass cocktail tea invented in Uganda? And if you have HIV opportunistic infection, would you take this plant extract from Kenya, which is just two questions. Take a minute and have a poll. So Joseph, are we done with the poll?
Yes, I think we're done. Let me end it.
Okay, please share the results. Oh, wow, interesting. It's literally split half and half. That's great. So actually both medications are real medications. They're actually real treatments. Both are actually patented and ready for commercialization. We will come back to do this to talk about this a little bit later and see why some of us actually have never even heard of them or why you don't trust this to medication. All right, so here we are in Africa. And Africa is facing many challenges. In sub-Saharan Africa, we bear about a quarter of the global disease burden, but we only have a small share of health workforce in the world. And this shortage is going to exacerbate drastically in the coming years. Rwanda is a very small country located in East Africa. And the capital city of Rwanda is in Kigali. Kigali is a beautiful, clean and safe city. It also has a lot of beautiful places for site visit. And if you come to Rwanda, you will enjoy it very much. UGHC is located in a very rural area in the northern part of Rwanda. And in this rural area, we have our beautiful campus. With the volcano as the backdrop, this is where our students learn and study. Now, the mission of UGHE, as the name implies, is to create equity and provide opportunities for people who otherwise may not have the chance to receive quality education in the rural area so that we can engage with the community, with the goal to learn from them as well as to assist the development, generate opportunity, and through this, try to achieve equity in healthcare. So back to Rwanda. In Rwanda, the population is about 12 million people. About 20%, they are living in the urban setting. A decent proportion of the people that have access to clean water, as well as improved sanitation. The fertility rate is about 4. And the life expectancy is getting higher. We're pushing to 70, about 70 right now. Maternity mortality rate and infant mortality rates are decreasing. And it's actually performing among one of the better countries in Africa. The literacy rate is fairly decent, but still a significant portion of people are still living in poverty. Now, as you can see, Rwanda is experiencing a demographic transition, moving away from a typical high fertility, high mortality, low income country to a more industrialized setting where people are living a little bit longer. Now, naturally, the healthcare system needs to provide care for the population of this type. In Rwanda, most hospitals are public. The healthcare expenditure increased significantly in the last 20 years, but still is below the recommended 15% GDP. Rwanda is one of the few countries in Africa where have national insurance. So about 80% of the people are covered. Last year, because of the COVID, the number dropped a little bit because people are having a hard time financially. But the enrollment rate is relatively high. However, we don't really have enough beds. We don't really have enough doctors or nurses to meet the standard. So Rwanda is divided by different tiers of healthcare services. The country has five different provinces, the north, east, south, and west, plus the Kigali city. And all these are further divided into districts, sectors, cells, and villages. Now the range of services provided by all these different hospitals proportionally decrease as it's moved down the train, the specialty of the hospital from tertiary to the health post. But Rwanda has a very huge network of community health workers. They are the people responsible for the community-based health education, health promotion, and some basic curative treatments. Now, as you can see, the country is moving towards a different trend. We are getting older. We're having more chronic diseases. The country is carrying a double burden for both infectious and non-communicable diseases. There is a shortage of healthcare providers. The cost is increasing, and the health outcome is relatively inconsistent. So to address these needs, more creative and innovative methods to reduce costs, to improve healthcare is necessary. Now, as mentioned by Virginia last week, innovation is not just about creating a product or creating an app on your phone. It's also about providing the services or changing the process of how service is delivered. So I want to re-emphasize here because a lot of time when people think about innovation, about entrepreneurship, it's always about, oh, we have to use the app. And that's usually not the case, actually. So we just want to encourage everybody to think about innovation in a broader sense. Now, regardless what type of innovation it is, the key component about innovation is generating value for the customers. In this case, the population as well as the patients when it comes to healthcare. So innovation solutions are good, but in order to get there, there is not without challenges. Now in Rwanda, the mobile phone and internet usage increased significantly in the last two decades, as well as the GDP. However, the money we invested in research and development is less than 1%. And in 2018, there are about more than 2 million patents filed around the world, and only 6 were from Rwanda. So these numbers are showing there's a huge space for innovation to happen, and there is a huge gap to fill. So what are some of the challenges that we're facing? I'm going to share a couple of examples with you, and some of them are my firsthand experience. Some of them are some of the projects that I've seen in different countries implemented by different NGOs or different people. So the first one happened in somewhere around mid 2000, back in Ethiopia when I was working there. Now in Ethiopia, many health facilities are pretty remote. They're in highly isolated regions. So for them to keep track of the stock of the medications, they have to fill all this paper documentations. And these documentations, they have to be filed and sent to the central pharmacy in order to get restocked. And a lot of times, because of the remote location, this report failed to go back to the pharmacy. And as a result, most of the medications are not actually being replenished, and then they have stock out situation. This is pretty severe, and it was very common in a lot of health facilities. Now, back in 2005, 2006, this type of cell phones are the most popular ones, and actually it's almost like the gold standards. I think among the younger audience here, you may not have seen this type of phones before, but back then it was pretty much everybody has it. That's the prime time of Nokia. Now, at the same time, somebody in the chat says she had one of it. So you're just dating yourself here. Also back at the same time, mHealth was just about to start and it was getting some traction. It was getting more popular. So everybody was talking about mHealth and everybody was talking about what they have to do something about mHealth. So this NGO in Ethiopia created this system. So what they essentially do was you have to dial a number and then they create a simple Q&A form on the phone. So you answer the questions on the phone. The answer is pretty much basically the inventory information. So the idea is you punch in those information and then you can send the stock information to the central pharmacy so that they know what's going on. Now, because the phone wasn't a smartphone, so there's a capacity limit. So the NGO wants people to key in 5 drugs information as proxy to the stock information. So that's pretty much the system. Now, the idea of the system is to improve or reduce stock out, try to reduce remove the burden of the physical inaccessibility and reduce the workload for the frontline staff. So here I want to do my second poll. So what do you think the project had achieved? This particular mHealth project had achieved in terms of outcome. So Joseph, can you pull up the poll for me? That's right. So if you can take a minute to fill the poll. Hey, Joseph, do we have all the people answered?
6 more people.
Okay, we give them a few more minutes. Well, actually, a few more seconds.
Yes.
Cool. And when you're ready, show us the results. Oh, great. So most people thought the reporting time was reduced, stock out was reduced and improved the satisfaction. Nobody said the workload was reduced. Great. So now, obviously this survey, it was not a good survey because I gave you the biased result. All the answers that you can answer are positive. So this is actually what happened. I did not implement the project. So the stock out did not resolve. We still have severe stock out issue there. Now most people in the health facilities, they find it very hard to enter the supply chain information on a small phone. Now there are a lot of numbers involved, particularly we talk about inventory. So punching in all these numbers in a small phone, in a small form is actually very challenging. Now, of course, people are actually having a hard time try to even just get a signal in a remote area. And because of the mHealth system they created only allowed people to record 5 items on the phone. So most people just still have to continue to do the paper-based system. So actually the system increased the workload for the frontline worker. And we create a parallel system here. So I want to use the example to show people sometimes when people develop something simply because it is the trend, it is the sexy thing to do, only because everybody is doing it And sometimes it got the opposite effect. Only because everybody's doing it, this doesn't mean it is the good thing to do. So a lot of NGOs are actually consistently making the same mistakes. Now, in the second case, this is an app created by my friend, actually, in Rwanda. So now in Rwanda, there are a lot of road traffic accidents happening here. When an accident happens, when you have to save lives, every minute counts. So in Rwanda, we don't really use the street address. So without the street address, that can cost the ambulance a few more extra seconds, few more extra minutes to arrive at the scene. And sometimes the traffic there can cause further delay. And also when the ambulance get to the hospital, if the hospital has no availability in terms of bed or the staff, the ambulance has to turn around and go to another place. That will obviously add a few more minutes to the delay. So all these are causing some trouble in terms of providing healthcare to the people with the injury. So the system my friend created was basically a single call system. Now this is how it works. When an accident happened, people call the emergency number. Now the system will send a GPS to the ambulance so that they know where to go. Now the system will also coordinate with the traffic light to make sure they're giving the ambulance the green light to go, so to avoid traffic. And at the same time, they simultaneously find out which hospital is available and direct the ambulance to go there. So by creating this system, the idea of the project is to minimize the delay for healthcare. So now here comes to my last poll. Do you think this program has value? So if you can fill out the poll for me. Do you think this program has value? Joseph, are we done?
Not yet, a few more seconds.
Okay. Okay, good. So the majority of you think this program has value. Great, I will tell my friend that. So what actually happened was this program never took off because we couldn't find funding, or he couldn't find funding. The road accident to a lot of funders is not a priority. And the irony is actually the government loves the program. They actually want to take ownership of the program. And that's what all the global health program global health programs want. We want the local government to take ownership of any programs that we want to do. But the irony is by taking ownership, this program also is not qualified as an entrepreneurship project. So they also eliminated themselves from getting certain type of funding. So that's the irony of it. So the last example is a project I actually designed myself. I set it up when I was working in Saudi Arabia. So this is a project in a hospital in Saudi Arabia. The project is very simple. The billing system they used back then was using a paper-based system, and naturally it was full of error and it was time consuming. So what I did was we introduced a computer billing system there. We designed a system. I actually designed a system, I arranged all this stuff, and we tested out. This is a screenshot of the program. Now, it was all in Arabic. I put the English there just for you to understand what it is. So it was in Arabic. We tried to use as much as possible using drop-down menu, so minimize data entry error. We tested out. The computation is very easy. So the way to work is you click on the button, just like any drop-down menu, and then they can select what they want to select. And they literally do not have to type in anything. So in that way, they can actually minimize any data entry error. Computation is 100% accurate. We tested out in many situations and it totally worked. However, the staff in the hospital, they refused to use the system. So later on, I realized they did not want to use the system because part of that is the local culture. Now in Saudi Arabia, they're very uptight about the culture and they're very strict about the religion and the whole practice, the traditional practice. After all, it's Saudi Arabia. In the country, they read from right to left. So they do not like this drop-down menu button and they want it on the left-hand side. So when they read, the button is on the left side, and they also want the drop-down menu to read from right to left. And that's the reason they do not want to use the system. Now, obviously, this is an easy fix. But to me, this is the classic example about culture. And when you're in school, people talk about you have to be aware of the culture a lot. You have to be sensitive about the culture or not. But at school, I never fully understood what it meant. Just like, okay, try to understand the culture. To me, that was my very first concrete experience about how culture can break a perfectly functioning system. We tested it, we tried it out, we tried to put in anything we want to see whether the computer, the system will accept error. And everything was working perfectly, except nobody used it because of the local culture. Now, obviously we had to fix it and that was fine. But this is an example of how culture will affect will put in a burden in terms of the implementation. So I just want to use these three examples to highlight some of the challenges that we face in create solutions, particularly in low middle income countries. Now, people tend to follow the trend. Now, regardless the value generated. Now, not all innovations are good and not all innovations have to follow what is popular at that time. Like the cell phone example, only because mHealth was popular at that time, it was the new trend, it doesn't mean that people have to follow it. It goes back to the fundamentals of innovation. Are we providing value to the customers? And I think that's the key issues that we have to follow. A lot of NGOs, a lot of people, when they create a solution, they try to be innovative and try to be edgy, but at the same time, they forgot about the fundamental reason we are providing all this, creating all this innovation. And also remember, innovation is not always about a product, about an app, about an object. Sometimes changing the process is also innovation. So don't just blindly chasing the shiny object. And that is important. And it became a huge burden in a lot of innovation, particularly in global health in developing countries right now. Now, the second challenge is we often forgot to consider the local situation. Now, whether it's about the environment, the skill, the culture. Now, NGOs are notorious about this. We're very guilty in making this mistake. Many created some kind of product, some kind of project back in the home countries, and then just want to bring it and roll it out in another country, and then they hope it will work, and often failed. Another things NGOs are extremely guilty of is creating parallel systems. I have done that before, and I'm just as guilty on this as any other people. Now, a lot of NGOs, they have their own mandate. Actually, every NGO, they have their own mandate. NGO A is doing HIV, so they create the entire HIV system from registration to supply chain. And NGO B is doing diabetes, so they are creating the entire diabetic system from registration to supply chain again. And then NGO C is doing maternal child health, they would create their own system. And all in the name of helping you to make your work easier. And they always come in, it's like, our system will make your life easier. Our system will make your work less. And not knowing the front line staff, now they have to repeat the same work 3 times, 4 times, or 5 times. And this is always a problem that are happening in a lot of global health situation. Now, finance is obviously is an issue, particularly in low-income countries. Now, many innovative projects were not getting enough fundings because the funders, they have their own strategy. They always have their strategic directions. Whether these directions are actually what the country or the community needs, it may be a different story. And of course, funding is not always available. And we often have to wait for the right timing to get the fund. And if there are one common issue about funding is the funding mechanism. Oftentimes, these fundings require a US or European partners. Otherwise, we cannot even apply. Now, I'll show you a couple of examples here. Now, this is a RFP for projects going on in Kenya. So if you're not UK registered company, you cannot even apply for the funding. Now, this is another RFP. So they're funding for research project in a foreign country, but the irony is the entire project has to be performed in USA. So now, after reading it out loud, it almost sounds ridiculous, right? But this type of funding mechanism are more often than we want to admit. And this is one of the huge issues when it comes to funding in a developing country for innovation or just implementation alone. Now, most innovators are scientists, are public health professionals. They know the science or the implementation of the solution, but they don't necessarily know the business behind it. So our poll at the very beginning about the lemongrass cocktail was an example. The lemongrass tea was actually a product, but not everybody knows about that, and less people are trusting it. There are a lot about the business, the marketing skills involving innovations in order to make it work, in order to make it successful. And there's a general lack of entrepreneurship skills among the health sectors. And that's why Virginia's lecture last week about entrepreneurship and the two lectures, the two workshops in the coming next 2 weeks are so important. It is really important for us to form partnership and tap into the skills and the resources of private sector. So if we want to create sustainable solution in health, the last challenge I want to highlight is about the mindset. Now, obviously, this is not about just Germany. It's just the whole mindset. A lot of time, I've seen it over and over again. Even people within their own countries, they do not trust their own product can be good. There is a bias opinion about things coming from developing countries are always substandard. This kind of mindset can put a huge roadblock to any kind of development. Now, this is just a picture of the funding landscape in Africa. As you can see, we really, really need a lot more investors to come to Africa. Now, the good thing about Rwanda is we have a very supportive president who strongly believes in science, technology, and innovation. So making Rwanda a really good place to be creative and innovative. Now I want to end my presentation with a few examples of what are currently happening in Rwanda. Now in some places in Rwanda, particularly in the rural regions, it's still very hard to reach. Zipline is a company using drones to deliver blood and small medical supplies to these hard to reach places. They started in Rwanda in 2016, and now they have two locations in Rwanda. And between these two locations, they're covering 80% of the country so that they can deliver all these items within an hour to the hospitals or to the health facilities. During this pandemic, obviously a lot of innovation happened. Rwanda uses these robots to assist in handling COVID cases. these robots, they can take your temperature, detect if you're wearing the mask correctly, and provide a lot of health information about the pandemic. So if you come to Rwanda, when you go to the airport, you will see these robots there. And last week, Regina mentioned one of her projects was manufacturing the hand sanitizers. And actually, coincidentally, we actually did the same project in a hospital in Rwanda. So this was a project I personally got involved. And we were in a hospital, we set up the entire production line. And we even used the lab to randomly test the sample to make sure they are up to standard and they're actually working. So the hospital can now, because of this project, provide sufficient hand sanitizers for the entire hospital. So they have no stock out issue. And at the same time, they saved 71% of the money on the budget on hand sanitizer. So all these projects, all these examples are happening in Rwanda. And it's actually quite exciting. Now, this seminar series is about encouraging our students or our audience to think creatively. Now, I want to jumpstart this process by leaving you a list of potential areas that I think that can be innovative, and innovation in these areas can help tremendously in improving healthcare. So this is just a list I created. By no means this is correct, or by no means this is exhaustive. But I also want to remind people, don't let this list limit your thinking. Take this as a starting point. And I hope by giving you some ideas here, I want you to start looking around, looking at things surrounding you in a critical and different way, and think about how you can improve it by thinking outside the box. Don't do the traditional thing, and don't just think about innovation is creating an app or creating a product. It can be anything. Sometimes by changing the process, sometimes creating a new business model, quality improvement, all these are innovative ways to help us to improve the healthcare outcome. That concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wong. That was excellent. Please, we have plenty of time for questions. So again, everyone, I see clapping hands, and that was a great presentation. We have plenty of time for questions. So you can either type your question in the chat, or you can use the raising hand I think we can raise our hands, right? If you click on your name, I think there's an opportunity to do that. And just to let us know that you would like to ask a question.
Let me close my share so that I can see the chat box. Cool.
All right, I do see, I think maybe a hand raised or a clapped hand, I'm not sure, but from UGHE Zoom, MGHD.
It's gone. They don't want to ask questions.
Maybe they're clapped. They look similar. So I can maybe start us off with a question. I think maybe we can spend, because this came up a little bit in our last session when we talk about culture, right? And some of the lessons that you learned from your experience in Saudi Arabia and dealing with culture. So knowing that, yes, we teach about culture, we talk about its importance, and then what it looks like kind of on the ground is very different. Is there something that, like, if I knew then what I know now, right? Like, are there particular takeaways or ways that you would have had people involved in the development? What would you have done differently in retrospect?
So I think one thing we always say, but we don't do, is actually involving the people from the culture, from mm-hmm. the inside. I mean, we're all guilty about, at least I'm the first one to say that I was guilty about this. In school, we talk about, we have to include the people. We have to include the people from inside so that they know better. But a lot of time we say that, but we don't do that. We include the people just because the funding requirement, we need have a local partner so that we can apply for the grant, and then we do that. And I used to be one of those people. It's like, okay, let's just put the name there. They're not going to contribute much, but we need a person there. So obviously this mindset, in hindsight, we cannot be more wrong. So I would definitely encourage people, if they're really doing something in a culture that they're not familiar with, or in a population that they don't belong to, they really need to have a person from the inside who actually want to do the project. And a lot of times when we find people to do the project, just like, hey, do the project with us, you don't really have to do anything. And that obviously is not helping us in terms of creating the actual the scenario or the cultural component of it. So if I can go back in time 20, 30 years ago and tell myself, you should, one thing that you should do about culture is about actually intentionally and carefully involve people in a meaningful way.
That's great. Meaningful inclusion, meaningful from as early as possible. That's a great point. I see a hand from Nsangawa, and then we'll go to the next question in the chat.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me?
We can. Feel free to introduce yourself and then ask your question.
My name is Emmanuel Sanganwa. That is a hard name. It is a Kinyarwanda name. I'm actually a student at Babson College, and I'm from Rwanda. I'm glad that UGHE is here, because 2 years ago, UGHE was my dream university. And I want to be a health care practitioner, but now it comes with entrepreneurship, my spot. I did not have chance to attend the previous session, but I did the follow-up or watched the recording and read the follow-up readings. While reading the follow-up reading, I came to realize or to appreciate the idea of design thinking. Just to add on the idea Professor Glover raised, design thinking or human-centered designing is when you understand clearly what people need and are willing to pay what are their needs and desires. So I was wondering, within the all project that failed, that Professor Rex said, I was wondering, to what extent did they involve design thinking, not just to consider the culture, but also people's needs, people's desire, and willingness to pay, to what extent? If not, what is now being considered to be done differently to ensure that all those projects, all those startups or ventures will be welcomed by potential or targeted customers or users? Thank you.
Yeah, so I think it goes back to the fundamentals of innovation. Why are we doing all these new projects? Why are we creating solutions? The basic fundamental question is like, what value are we generating for the people? So the core component of human-centered design is actually about what people want. And if we can actually follow that mindset, whatever you call it, whether it's a human-centered design or just asking people to talk about what's going on, what do they want? As long as we understand the core of this, I think that's the important part, because if we do not know what the population, what the people actually wants, what is valuable to them, the problem is not going to be solved. And the product or the solution you're going to generate is not going to help, because nobody wants to use it. And a lot of times for NGOs, particularly like in the States, it happens a lot. They have this training that they want to do. They got a funding, they want to do all this stuff, and then they just roll it in the country. And in the past, a lot of times, because the receiving countries, they don't really have a lot of bargaining power, because we need the money, we need the funding to come in. So we just said yes. So a lot of times, whether the project is actually generating value for them, it wasn't the most important thing, but the money coming in, it was more important. That's about the physiological need of the people. So I think this is one of the crime that all these NGOs were involved in, actually still involving in many situations. So I think in order to address your question, we really have to think about what kind of value, what kind of things that people really want to do. And it goes back to my first, the answer to the first question. Involve the people from the very beginning. Ask them what they want, what is actually important for them. And if you're creating something just for the sake of using the funding because you got a grant, that is not going to be helpful for people. And I think maybe Regina also have some other perspective in this area when it comes to entrepreneurship too.
Yeah, I think, you know, very similarly, I think one of the most powerful things that you said to me, Professor Rong, was that this is a tendency in a lot of different techniques, right? So whatever you want to call it, today we're talking more about design, you know, design thinking is more popular right now. But if I think back to the way that we thought about quality improvement or like whatever, you know, all of our approaches to change, we tend to give lip service to the idea of including the people or people being the most valuable resource and what that looks like. And just to make sure that we're really doing that work. At the end of the day, and I too have been guilty of like saying, yes, we're going to do this. And then kind of when the rubber meets the road, not being as dedicated to it as we should. And I think another thing that comes to mind is being willing for things to go slow. Like, I think sometimes if you need to have more people at the table, that may mean that the initiative or whatever that you had in mind may go slower, it may go in a different direction, right? And you have to be more flexible and patient in order to do that kind of work. So that also came to mind. We have a question from Gloria. If you're in a place where you can unmute, feel free to do so and to ask your question, Gloria. It's a great one.
Sure. Hi, Dr. X. So my question was more specifically on the issue of undervaluing health innovations from low resource settings. So for myself and other global health leaders that are upcoming, what do you consider to be our role in addressing these challenges and driving forward sort of these homegrown solutions to some of the health issues that face the African continent?
Great. So this is a really good question because I really think this is an important issue. So a lot of times as I presented in, as I mentioned in the presentation, there's nothing wrong about the innovation or the solution that people created. And a lot of time they actually generate value, but people do not know. And largely because of the marketing. Now, I know a lot of times when we talk about marketing, it sounds like a very business-oriented approach. But that's exactly why in this global health setting, a lot of projects failed because nobody knew about the project. And whether you want to call it marketing, call it an announcement, call it community sensitization, that's just the terminology. But a lot of times people are not actually utilizing the proper skills in telling people this product exists. And the fact that half of the people did not know the lemongrass tea created in Uganda is actually a way to treat malaria. Or a lot of people, they really do not know and do not understand these products are actually working. So that says a lot about we do not know in terms of global health nonprofit organizations. We do not know the importance of marketing. A lot of times when you think about marketing, it's Coca-Cola putting a commercial and they try to get money. We are better than them. We're not that type of organization. We're here to save lives, so we don't need advertisement. And that's actually not true. So if you remember in my class, so Gloria was my former student. So in the management class, a lot of this is about the business skill, the entrepreneurship skill that historically global health sector tried to avoid or try to ignore. And And I think these days we cannot ignore it anymore, just because if you look at all these for-profit organizations, they are so much better than us. And all these global health programs that we implemented in all these low-income countries, they failed. And that's so much, that says so much about, there's something about the for-profit organization, the business skills, the entrepreneurship skills that we need to learn and we can borrow from, or we can collaborate with all these private sectors so that we can actually push the public health in a better way. So I think that's something we really need to do to develop some more business skill in the global health arena. And then obviously advocacy about the funding resources is important, because a lot of times the funders are back in the States, back in UK, back in Europe. They're so far, so remote from what's going on. They have their own strategic directions, whether the strategic direction is actually what the country needs. That's an issue here. So I have seen a lot of good projects. They died prematurely just because they did not get sufficient funding for that. Or they finished the pilot phase and then they're great. They're actually working. So they submit a paper and got published, and that's pretty much the end of the project. And all these half-baked projects, they're good, but they never actually took off. So guys will have to consider how we can actually maintain this program beyond the pilot phase, or just doing it one region, one sector, or one hospital, and actually scale it up into a bigger program and let people know about this and solicit funding and make sure the funders, they know about all this program and they're willing to do to support all this kind of program.
Great point. It also makes me think about, and I thought about this after, I think it was Leah's question from last week, and she has one this week as well, that we'll get to in a moment. But it makes me think about, you know, back to the question of business models that we were discussing, right? And that as, because I think healthcare entrepreneurs have a unique challenge. On the one hand, we're trying to prove, right, the efficacy of whatever we're rolling out. And on the other hand, it has to be fundraising and how do you make it financially sustainable? And so there was something about both Gloria's question today and Leah's from yesterday that made me think about one organization called DASH. So this is in Haiti. And I see Dr. Claire Pierre. So she's our executive director. She's on the call, so she could maybe talk a little bit more about this company. But from its inception, it was started by a doctor who saw the need for more healthcare, but didn't want to kind of be in the bind of always having to raise funding. And so he essentially created an insurance company, but it was a very, very low cost, right? So to not always think about no cost, but to think about low cost, what is affordable? And at least that gives you some baseline. So over the years, it's been going for a very, very long time now, but the equivalent of like $1, $5, $10 a month. And he had kind of this tiered system that was a way of him financially sustaining the business. And it worked for him. So I think, you know, with these, even with a homegrown solution, as you're, you know, proving the efficacy, you know, at the same time, we have to think about this parallel stream of what does that financial model look like over time. But Gloria, that was a great question. I also love the tea example. I was like, let's get in the tea business. That was because that's really promising. And I hadn't heard about that at all.
Well, Rwanda is the number one tea export, you know. We should do this project here.
Makes sense.
Yeah. All right. I also see a question from Leah.
Yeah.
But I think the question is almost like a glorious question. I think I kind of answered that. How do we share idea and to actually don't waste all this half-baked idea because of the funding issue? So I think I kind of answered that question, but one thing I probably want to add a little bit on this question is the exact idea why Virginia and I were doing this is we want to create a forum so that we can share experience. The partnership actually supplement each other's experience and expertise. We want to use this as the platform to share all the ideas that we can do together so that we won't waste it. So I have a lot of ideas about how we can create a system to help pushing the healthcare forward in this country. But at the same time, I absolutely have no technical background in terms of, if you ask me to create an app, I do not know how to do that. If you ask me how to promote all this product, Virginia's University, Babson over there, they have way more experience than we have. So that's why we have this partnership to share this experience. This is one of the steps that we want to take together to promote all these half-baked ideas so that we don't want to let all this good idea die prematurely. Some of you may not know, so Virginia and I were collaborating on our first innovative product here. Some of my students already know, but if you are if you were not, if you haven't heard of it, so currently we are creating an app for the deaf community in Rwanda. So there are a significant portion of people that have hearing disability in Rwanda, and then you can imagine when they are having healthcare issue, going to the hospital without the ability to communicate is so challenging. So in the past, people go to the hospital, they have to be escorted by interpreter to translate the sign language for them. And the Rwanda National Union for the Deaf, they actually provided a lot of sign language training to the hospital for the doctor and nurses. And obviously it wasn't very particularly fruitful because asking people to learn a sign language to a level that you're proficient to communicate, to talk about your healthcare issue is actually very challenging. So it hasn't been very useful. So we have this idea of creating an app. It's a motion sensor app so that we can, so when the people sign in front of the screen, they can translate the words so that the doctors can understand what's going on. And then when the doctor type in the information, can also translate the sign language so that the patients can understand. So this is a way to facilitate the communication to promote health equity here for the people with this hearing disability. So this is a project that if we didn't have this collaboration, I'm still trying to figure out how we can actually do it. By forming this collaboration with Babson University, they have the engineering department, they have the IT department, they have the entrepreneurship department to support all this. And what they don't have is like what's happening in Rwanda. And that's exactly why we have this collaboration, and then we have our Rwandan students plus the Babson students to work on this project together. And through this is obviously step one. And then through this collaboration, we're hoping this will continue, and then we'll gain more traction to attract more funders to come in and see this is actually working by helping us to promote this kind of idea or this kind of sharing. So hopefully that addressed the answer the question Leah posed about how we can support all these ideas, but we don't have the funding.
Yeah. Leah, did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
I see another question from UGHE Zoom. Would you like to unmute and ask a question?
Yes, thanks. Dr. Rex talked about innovation not just being apps or being the shiny things, but rather also involving improving a process, innovating in a way that you change a process, let us say within the hospital. And from my experience, I've maybe noticed that sometimes processes are developed through quality improvement, you know, approaches, and these processes provide value, but you find that people within either the hospital or within healthcare are very resistant even before trying out. They don't want to change. They want to continue doing maybe the way they were doing the old stuff. They don't want to adopt this new process or this new innovation. So I would want to know, or like, what solutions, what ways do you bring people to your side to adapt to this new innovations, especially the ones that don't have a physical, let us say physical product, because when there's a physical product, there is more interest. But when it's a process, it's intangible, and then there is no, I would say it's hard to find traction and people to adapt to this new innovation.
Great. This happened quite a lot, actually. And if I say I have an answer to that, we won't even be here. So this is a question that I think it's just a continued improving process. So that question has a couple of aspects to it. So I'm actually very happy that you asked the question, because the simple answer is going back to what we said before. Obviously, you have to involve the people from the ground that they actually want the project, because if they don't want the project, there's no way that they will buy it and they don't want to do it. And the other thing is, we really want to know what they want. And when I say want to know what they want, we have to know what they really, really want. Because a lot of times people, when a foreigner comes in and they say, oh, we can help you to do this and that, they always say yes. People always say yes, whether it's out of polite, being polite, or out of the sick that I just want to brush you off. I don't want to deal with you, just so I just say yes. It happens quite a bit. There are a lot of NGO fatigue in this global health arena. And so understanding what they really want is important. I can give a very clear example that one of the projects I conducted is a quality improvement project in the hospital when I was in Egypt. So we go to the hospital, they complain to us that we have too much crowding in the hospital. Every time you go there in the morning, it's overcrowded and the patients are everywhere. We're overwhelmed by the work. So they constantly complain about that. So we go in and then we did our whole analysis. We said, okay, great, let's do the, so finally we came up with a solution. Let's do a scheduling system. And it's difficult to schedule patients by specific hours. So we cut the time into blocks, early morning, early afternoon, early morning, mid morning, late morning, early afternoon, mid afternoon, day afternoon. So that people come in blocks. So they don't have to come early in the morning at 6 o'clock and wait until 5 o'clock if they knew they have an appointment at 3 p.m. So that sounds like a very logical solution. And then we created all this and we set up the system and it worked. So we implemented the system and we drastically reduced the overcrowding and the waiting time. And I think if I remember correctly, the waiting time reduced by almost 80%, the overcrowding reduced by almost 80% just by following the system. Now the system works and we talked to the people and we thought that's what they want. But at the end, they didn't want the system. Now the staff are complaining and they're complaining now because we have a scheduling system. In the past, we had a lot of patients in the morning. We were very overcrowded and we were very busy, but we try to finish everything in the morning so we can go home in the afternoon. And then now with a scheduling system, we knew patients are coming at 2, 3, 4, 5. We cannot run away. So initially I thought we know what the people want, but we really need to know what they actually want. So what they actually want is completely something different. A lot of times, people come in and we're relying on the frontline workers to help us to implement the project or the solution that we want out of the internal motivation. So we always said in all this motivation training courses, we always said internal motivators are better than external motivator. But in reality, if the external motivator is not there, forget about internal motivation. You cannot just rely on saying, this is for your own good. This is for helping you internally. This will make you a better person. So all these words are buzzwords if these people don't have enough money to buy food, put food on the table. So I think there are a lot of, obviously a lot of socioeconomic issues behind that. Paying your staff in a proper way so that they can actually start talking about beyond the physiological level. Now, I think this morning for the MGHG students, you're talking about leadership. You're talking about the basic different levels of motivation or the needs. The most basic need of people is the physiological needs. If the people don't get enough salary, if they don't get enough money to feed the family, we cannot just go in and being arrogant, saying that if you do this, it will make your life better. You will be a better person. And that's just BS. That's just not working. So I don't have a concrete solution on that. But what I would say is I encourage people to think about what the people actually want. And don't be arrogant coming in and say our system will make your life better. Because if we're not actually making their life better, don't pretend that we are. And that's an important part that I have learned from my years working. And then obviously money is an important issue. If you don't have enough money to support the program, and you're just asking people to do more work for you, multiple different parallel systems, which NGOs always create. And that's a huge issue going on.
Yeah, and if I could just add to what Professor Wong just laid out for us, is I think, you know, too often we think about process improvement as being projects, as opposed to being, this is the way that the workers at this clinic or this hospital improve their own processes. And internal motivation works if it's their ideas and it's things that they want to do to improve their processes. It doesn't work if it's not their ideas and it's not the things that they see that they want to do to improve their processes. So much, and I love our collaboration because Dr. Wong has all these great practical examples and my brain goes to, you know, the literature that just says, if you don't have not only just buy-in, but it has to be their ideas, right? So that the frontline workers are the one generating the solutions regularly. And that's, I think that's universal, right? I've been in places, I've been in flipping from healthcare, let's talk about manufacturing, right? Where there are plants that will, you know, try to do these process improvements and they fail miserably, but others that really take the frontline workers' ideas and they celebrate them, right? So they say that this worker had an idea to, you know, minimize the turnaround time. And so they get an award that day or, right, but it's their ideas. And I think the more that we can really tap into the ideas of the people that are doing the work, the more that we'll have a sustained process improvement system in some of these hospitals and clinics. But that's, I think that's a very great question and a universal problem. So I haven't seen any other questions come in. Does anyone else have questions or thoughts? And before we do that, I'll just mention that we do have a feedback link that's in the chat. So please click on that. You can provide your feedback from session one and session two using that same link. So please do so. Any other questions for Professor Wong? I see just a comment. ZA2235, would you like to just chat with us a little bit about the reference or the resource that you're providing for us?
Sure. Nice to see everyone. This is Sahira. Congratulations on the partnership and on the amazing presentation. I think it sparked so many ideas thus far among everyone who's on here. And I was just sharing a link to a paper that's about sort of the uptake and or the scale up of loosely innovations, but maybe to Joseph's question, sort of practices and processes. And it presents this one model, and there are many out there, but I thought this may be helpful. And it's the aided model of diffusion or dissemination or uptake that may be of use. So just sharing in the chat. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And I think to that point, you know, a lot of the diffusion and kind of adoption models that I've seen, I haven't looked at this one, so I'd love to hear from you, Doctor, on this one. But it really uses relationships, right? That these have to be relational models of acceptance and adoption and spread. When we make them transactional, like thou shalt do this, then yes, you need that external, you know, I need my carrot to do what you just told me to do, right? But if we make them more relational, then we tend to get better uptake and adoption.
Great. And I just want to remind everyone, don't forget the next 2 weeks, we still have two more exciting lectures here.
We do.
The people helping us to do these two lectures are very exciting.
Yes, so just a quick announcement that we do for my US people, just remember that we're about to switch to daylight savings time. So the time will change for us. The sessions will be at 9 instead of 8. So just keep that in mind for people that are in the US, well, East Coast on the US. And the next session, for those of you that are interested in more of the nuts and bolts of entrepreneurship, we'll be walking through Babson's signature methodology, Entrepreneurial Thought in Action, that will be taught by Professor Candy Brush and Dr. Claire Cecile Pierre. And our final session on digital health will be taught by one of our faculty who is also the CEO of a digital health company, Kenna Cardi. So we look forward to having you all with those sessions if there aren't any other questions. Oh, Leah, I see your hand.
Thank you very much, Jack and Regina, for this amazing sessions that you've been providing us this past weeks. Y'all look like you're doing a lot of work in the social enterprise space and developing solutions, either products or applications or systems. And I know that is a particular skill to acquire, because Rex in class always talks about an idea he's having or innovation he's working on. So how might you, or how would you allow or tell someone to exercise their ideation mind? Like, because these things you have to really well thought out, you have to do some level of research and have the connections and also the diffusions while interacting with communities. But how do you have that muscle to identify good ideas, network for those ideas to hold root and build something, especially if you're new to this? Thank you.
That's such a great question. I think I will also, if I remember, to ask that of Professor Brush, because she's been doing this for much longer. I think, you know, what we have our students practice is ideating, right? So we do a lot of it. A lot of brainstorming, a lot of ideation, a lot of, I think what they'll talk about if we have time, is a lot of blue sky thinking, right? So to practice thinking about, in that ideal world, what would you want to have? And then to bring it down to something that's more practical, and just doing it over and over again. So I think, you know, being able to practice and to kind of flex that creativity helps us, because I think so often we get, you know, more in the mindset, and this is, I'm an engineer by training. So we get in a very kind of practical kind of process improvement mindset, which is great and is an important tool, but that ideation or that creativity can sometimes lay dormant. And so there's a lot on, you know, being able to use improvisation, to think about jazz, right? To think about creativity, to do creative things, and how that helps you to come up with these ideations and practicing that ideating mind. Now, to your other question about then how do things take root, then we have to go back to, you know, the systems and the processes. So once we have that idea, and ideally we've had people in the community or the frontline workers going alongside us as we created that idea, then it's about, well, how do we really root it and scale it? And there's a lot of different techniques. So I think this collaboration grows, you know, our idea is that eventually there'll be an innovation lab where we can really grow some of these ideas together, because there are slightly different techniques if we're talking about products or services or, you know, processes, and depending on kind of the community and where they're being placed. So then it's not as one size fits all. So those are my thoughts, but Professor Wong, anything to add there?
No, I think you said it all. It's very comprehensive, actually.
Yeah, but a great question. And I think for those of you that want to be kind of more directly involved, we'll continue to have the seminar series, and we're very excited. But I think if there are those of you that want to be more directly involved in kind of the development of the innovation lab, you know, feel free to reach out individually, because I think it may be what I'm remembering as we're doing all of this is we want to get you all involved, right? I don't want Professor Wong and I to go build something that you all don't want. And so I think it will be ideal if we can end up with kind of a team of students that are kind of ambassadors or kind of helping us as we go along with our design. So feel free to reach out to me directly. I'll put my email address in the chat, and you've probably gotten emails from me already if you're signed up for this listserv, and feel free to reach out directly. Any other questions before we wrap up today? This was a great session. Thank you so much, Professor Wong. And we'll have it posted on our Canvas site as well for those who want to revisit it or who weren't able to join us live today.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us.
Great. Well, thank you all so much, and have a good day. We'll see you next week.
Bye.